interested in property and architecture. Hi, my name is Max DeRose from DeRose SAR, and I'm speaking in this podcast series to different professionals involved in the design and delivery of residential property. So this week, I'm very happy to be joined by Ben Warren, who's director of Regency Grove Property Consultants. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's good to have you here. We've done a bit of work together, and hopefully we'll do a bit more. So I'll just launch straight into the questions and we can get cracking. So you're a founding director of Regency Grove, which is a new business. Why did you start your own business?
Me and the fellow directors had been discussing it, talking about the opportunity to set up on our own for months or probably even years by the time we actually got around to doing it. And it was a case of when's the right time. There's always risks personally and in the industry. But we wanted to grab both the opportunity with both hands, and we felt there was an opportunity in the market for a company like us, all experienced. We've held senior positions and known each other for several years, and we wanted to have control of the service, the product that we provide, mm-hmm. and the way that we do that.
That sounds very good. And so now you're 1 year on, and can you explain, perhaps in a bit more detail, what Regency Grove does and maybe some of the projects you were involved in at the moment, just to kind of flavour the picture.
So we're coming up to our first year anniversary, which has gone really quite quickly. We're trying to pause to enjoy it as we go, okay. Which is a struggle because the weeks are flying past.
Yeah, that's a good sign, I think, no?
Yeah. Every week you're going, oh, right, that's another week done. Wow, okay. Which is, a good sign. We're further along than we had originally planned in terms of the company arrangement, the setup, our own office space, employing, things like that.
That's good.
I don't know if that was just because we didn't know how the market would react to us joining as our own company. But in terms of what we do, so we're a multidisciplinary surveying company. We offer project management, quantity surveying, building consultancy, and project monitoring. My experience is heavily in the super prime residential market through to multi-unit developments. But we cover all bases in terms of commercial, leisure, things like that as well. In terms of what we've secured at the moment, we've on the project management and QSing side, it's mainly residential, where we've got schemes from super prime single units in Mayfair, St John's Wood, places like that, through to zone 3 150 unit schemes at the kind of mid-level end of the market. So we're spreading ourselves there. In the building consultancy team, we're working with some kind of key corporate clients in the West End and the city, which is quite exciting, looking at what their CapEx plans for next year. And then the monitoring, which has taken off really well. Got quite a few lenders, and we're covering the southeast and London for schemes from 1 million to kind of 15 million as the top at the moment.
And is that all on the monitoring mainly residential? Or
yes, it's, I'd say 95% is residential, probably 100% is all residential for the monitoring team.
So the focus of this little podcast series is residential property. We're involved in residential design, I guess, prime residential. Mm-hmm. So that we met through working on a scheme. And I mean, you've had extensive experience working in residential property. So you started, I don't know if you started actually, but you've been working, I think you had a senior position at Bond Davison for over 10 years.
Yes. Yeah, so I worked my way up there to director of quantity surveying.
Okay.
I was there for 11 years, probably all in all.
Oh, I see. Okay. So can you describe briefly the type of projects you were involved in there at Bond Davison? Was it also prime resi?
Fundamentally, the prime resi was the key for us in terms of where we were positioned, created a name in the market for it in terms of servicing high net worth individual properties, single units in central London and the home counties. Those were ranging from £500,000 up to £60 million.
Okay, big schemes.
Yeah, but there's a range, not all of them.
Right.
But it was an interesting market, an interesting time to learn the trade in terms of most of the clients are demanding, can often be not very forgiving. They are where they are for a reason, most of them. So you've got to be on it all the time, and the eye for the detail, they have it as well. So they'll be checking you. And it's normally, okay, so it's their money. So they want to make sure it's in good hands and spent correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. And so 1 year on, do you think, and you've got your own company or with your co-directors, are you thinking, why didn't I do this earlier? Or are you thinking, no, this is good, I guess the often, I think personally, should we have waited a bit more and got more contacts? Because then I think the startup time accelerates.
Yeah.
Or do you launch yourself and you just learn on the job? Be interesting to see what you think, having...
There was definite apprehension.
At the beginning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it the right time? The market as it is?
It was quite a brave moment to go to.
Yeah. We've had some conversations where we said when we set up and where we were and how we've done it. And, oh, right. Okay. Oof. Brave or foolish, I don't know. We've done it and we're enjoying it and it's going the right direction.
That's great.
But in terms of should we have done it sooner, I think it was the right time.
Yeah.
Kind of not the stars aligned, but it was a good time for us all. And we've hit the ground running. Contacts have been receptive. Even new ones made, introductions made by contacts such as yourself have always been helpful and keen to help, which is really appreciated.
I suppose in a way, it's not a bad time to start because people are more cost conscious at the moment. And so it seems to be a role for people, professionals such as you. I don't know. I mean, that's my little theorizing.
I think, there is an opportunity for smaller companies. The idea that you have to have a big name architect or a large consultancy practice to ensure that your project is going to be a success is, I think, being edged out because of experience being had with smaller practices where you're getting the attention of the team, the director, the owners, and you can speak to them rather than seeing them once and then never again as a client.
I think that's a big advantage, of the smaller practices and offices. We certainly find that so, and clients seem to respond well, especially in the industry where we're in that prime resi, where funnily enough, the clients seem to be quite hands-on.
Yes, yeah, so I totally agree. Yeah,
they definitely want that attention to detail. And so during your, I was keen to understand whether there were any particularly memorable experiences along the way before you started Regency Grove.
Yeah, there was definitely some memorable clients and projects and meetings which bring back memories quite quickly, stressful times. And but it's often the case where you get a curveball project or something happens and those are the projects you remember, learn from and create strong relationships where you bed in as a team.
Yeah, that's true.
As a company, we've worked on some great projects in terms of Kensington Palace Gardens, the Hoover Building, Teddington Studios, Teddington Riverside, large scheme there, through to working with Christie's on gallery work and things like that, which is very kind of specialist.
I see.
So there's a real range that we're proud of and have had the opportunity to work on prestigious projects.
That sounds great. So I suppose in an attempt to try and make some use out of our conversations, hopefully some people will be listening to this who haven't had that much experience with residential project. If you were advising a client who had not commissioned a residential project before, would there be three bits of advice that you could tell him or her?
Well, if they hadn't purchased the property yet and they were still looking around the market in areas where they'd found where they want to live or something like that, it would be to invest some time and normal fees, I would imagine, in seeing what they can achieve with the property prior to completing or exchanging. Looking at it from a design, a planning, and cost and timeframe point of view to ensure that what they want or what they have in their mind is achievable, because often we've been brought into projects later down the line and then it's forever not the project they had imagined.
Right.
Which can be really disheartening for them and makes it just not as a full process as it could be.
That's interesting.
And then number two, probably listen to the advice that you're paying your fees for.
That's a good one.
Designers and consultants, they have the client's best interest in mind and have the experience and skills that they're using to advise. And construction projects, they're not a linear process. So there will be some bumps in the road. So you need to trust the advice you're paying for from the consultants you've employed. That goes across designers and other consultants.
Yeah, that's a very good, I think, bit of advice, and often one we find can be a bit challenging, especially as you were saying earlier, the people we're dealing with tend to be at the top of their game. So they usually really know their industry very well. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to go into an industry that they're less familiar with.
Sure. Yeah, I guess it's the delivery and the news and the information and how you handle that. Is key. That's something I've learned over the years. It's just the way you deliver good or bad news or whatever it may be, to break it down so it can be processed and managed and then move forward. And yeah, another fundamental is the selection of a contractor.
Oh, yeah.
There's some great contractors in London, but if you are, or the team are forced to tender or go with someone that's probably not appropriate for the project, but they're required to be involved and get on the job, it can always cause problems. So you should really be really considerate about who you're selecting and why.
So do your homework on the on the contractor.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. So we often recommend to go and visit. I mean, ultimately, it is so much about relationships, right? Maybe the bigger projects, the contract becomes much more, or you rely a lot more on the contract than you do on the slightly smaller ones, I suppose. But I still think that that relationship is so important. I suppose at every level, whether it's the architect and the client, or the client and the design team, and then the client and the contractor, you know, these projects take a long time, and if the relationship is not strong, or I think then you often can tell how the project's going to go on the quality of the relationship. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Yes. Yeah, generally, I wouldn't go for a contractor where I know or I can form a relationship quite quickly, where you can pick up the phone and speak to commercial director, MD, someone like that. So like I say, the project's probably going to have one or two bumps in the road. So you need to have that relationship where you can have an honest conversation, but trust that everyone's moving in the right direction or trying to pull in the same direction. Mm. That's not to say that you shouldn't work with new contractors and new consultants. It's, like you say, doing your homework, getting recommendations and finding out a bit about each other before you sign up to a year or 2 years together in a contractual relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's turn a bit more to design, or that's, you know, where our particular interest, and I suppose we call ourselves a design-led architecture practice, and we spend a lot of energy on the design, you know, promoting design and talking about design. And when I look at the communication that's coming out of the RIBA, there's a lot of concern that architects are slightly being marginalized on these bigger construction projects, and design is slowly being pushed out. I still think in residential projects, design plays a very strong place. Do you find in your experience that design is being pushed out?
Generally, no.
Okay.
No. Clients and the market in general, they're more and more educated, and a project designed purely, or designed and constructed purely on cost efficiency or something like that, I don't think it'd be very appealing to anyone.
That's true.
But it's a tough market at the moment, so developers need to focus on design to make themselves stand out so their assets are sellable.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. I mean, it's not always. I strongly believe in that principle that, you know, the design will differentiate you.
It doesn't need to mean that it's going to cost more.
Yeah, but it's quite hard to get that message across. I mean, I think you have to have a certain appreciation. Not every client or developer appreciates that, I think.
I'd agree, yeah.
So, yeah, it's. I think when you've can work with someone who has that appreciation, it is a much easier project, or satisfying project, I guess.
Yes, a successful project. Yeah. I'd agree. Even when you're dealing with high net worth individuals or private clients, they're equally demanding. They want to still know that they're not overcapitalizing on their property, but they still want a very design-led project. So you have to have that in mind for every project, that design is fundamental, it's key, it's the whole thing.
Yeah, I would hope so. Sometimes our projects, we struggle a little bit, as everybody does, I suppose.
Get ruined by QSs coming in today.
No. Definitely not Regency Grove. At the moment, it's funny, we've just finished a project in West London whereby we were designing as we were building. The client had a very tight time frame, and, you know, we set out the parameters of what would happen if we were going to go this way, and they were happy to go, so they knew the risk. But essentially, we negotiated with a contractor, and then we actually didn't have to go to planning on this one, and then we did the refurbishment as we were going, so we were producing information about 6 weeks ahead of they were building it. It was quite challenging.
Yeah. But
weirdly, in the last kind of 2 months, we've had two more clients who have come forward, and they also want to do this way. I guess, you know, these are prime resi. The clients tend to be in a hurry and or time is precious. And they've said when we've tabled the program, they've not been that impressed with the with the length of it. So the first question is, how do we speed this up? And I'm starting to think whether maybe it's we could tailor our approach so that we can actually offer this as something that can shortcut things. Obviously, it creates a lot more risk. I find it a very interesting thing to discuss in our practice about how we can slightly take the stress out of it and run it this way, almost a kind of just-in-time design and construction. And it feels like, you know, the way things are delivered in construction is the way they've been delivered for quite a long time.
I'd agree.
So I think, and to bring in, you know, radical change, I think it's quite hard in construction because it's all set up in a certain way. But so just keeping on this topic of change, do you think that residential construction and delivery is ready for change? And how might it be disrupted or change in the next few years?
Well, going back on your point about procurement and the manner in which design is overlapped with procurement and construction, I don't know, because that is a very, not very risky strategy, but it's very intense. And the relationship between you and the contractor has to be so close. And you have to be set up as a design team to package and provide information on deadline and then deal with, because I imagine it was a refurbishment rather than a new build, the curveballs. Yeah.
Yes.
That the building pushes back on you.
Yeah, that's right. So we identified a contractor that we'd worked with before, and then we went into a negotiated tender with them. So before we started on site, we could only be certain of about 75 to 80% of the cost. Mm-hmm. And we knew that, you know, 20, 25%, we weren't sure.
Because you hadn't designed it yet.
Because we hadn't designed it, yeah. We hadn't had the time to,
yeah, yeah.
To, you know, pick all the materials or the interior finishes or some of the rooms. So, but the client was comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had a few conversations about that. And so I guess there was a bigger contingency to deal with those kind of things.
For that to become a mainstream route, the relationship has to be so strong with the contractor. Whether that can happen on every project of any size is kind of questionable. And would every architectural practice be set up that they can manage that kind of intense program is interesting.
You're skeptical.
No, I'm not skeptical. I'm interested to see if it could be rolled out as a process.
I think one of the things that I find a bit frustrating is architecture school, we were drawing on a drawing board. And now we're, you know, everyone's working digitally. We still kind of, on most of our projects, well, we print something out and then that gets passed over to the design, the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're literally holding up drawings while they're building. And I mean, maybe that's getting a bit better. So some of them have iPads, but you're kind of transferring, you know, you're looking at a drawing and then you're building manually in a way.
It does feel a bit archaic.
It does, really does.
Like, and nothing's changed with the technology that we have for... But that's on projects of our size.
Yes. But so what I find interesting is if you can make that link between... So we're all working digitally and you push that digital information through to the actual fabrication. So, you know, just purely like on digital printing or something... Then there's not this leap into the manual side, which then goes into fabrication. You know, the stuff that we're drawing on the computer goes straight through to the laser or the inkjet arm, and it comes out, and it's all seamless, right? So then I'm thinking you can cut down on so much time because potentially you don't have to wait for something to be made. It's almost...
Well, it's instantaneous from your design.
Yeah, you can put it into production straight away. There's none of this kind of, I've got to schedule it. Well, I suppose there is, but I've got to form it through some other technique and see if we can meet your design. Nor have you got to rely on, I don't know, some person manually building it. So I'm kind of optimistic that once these digital fabrication methods become more mainstream, that we should see projects speeding up, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Technology is going to speed up the project and make it more efficient. And it is doing that at a larger scale. But when it's going to take time for it to trickle down into the smaller scale projects, that the main contractors on smaller scale projects are set up for it as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's a big investment at the moment.
The kind of more bespoke one-off projects.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not every project can have off-site construction or modern methods, but I think in time it will come. But it's just taking its time.
It is taking its time.
I don't think there's apprehension or pushing against it. It's just the technology needs to suit the project.
Yeah.
And when you say the design, it goes into production, what kind of, are you talking about any kind of particular products or materials or anything like that?
So there are two ways, I'd say. One is just imagine, joinery. We're designing a piece of joinery or something. We do the drawing. At some point, someone prints out that drawing and then it gets put on the workbench and then the joiner starts making things. And so they have to, I guess, the person making has a work day and then at night he or she have to go. And so you're working. There are shifts. And then the material itself kind of pushes back sometimes on what is possible and not possible. So I thought that, imagine working with the same material, but instead of it being manually kind of formed or cut, you're using kind of CNC machine to cut.
Yeah.
So that thing can roll 24 hours a day. You can just stack the projects behind each other. I mean, I'm thinking theoretically, obviously, practically speaking, it might not be quite like that. And then it just runs through, never gets tired. And so it feels like you could be running them more seamlessly. I think that would be the easiest one to imagine. Then harder to imagine is you're working with new materials that is maybe kind of, like at the moment a brickwork wall is still laid by a bricklayer or a blockwork wall.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you put, there was like in your van, there was a robot arm, you set it up.
Yeah.
And it just starts laying the brickwork and blockwork and it goes up and down. And those things would be as if you were renting a, what is that? Those kind of cement mixers, £200 a day or whatever. You'd bring it in, you'd set it up.
Set up and off it goes.
And it's got a rail and a hydraulic lift so it can do kind of 20 meters and it can start to go up 10 meters and off it goes. Yeah, I kind of think those things...
There's definitely a space for that.
That's so exciting.
Exactly, yeah. There's opportunities there, but the nature of every construction project is different and every situation occurs. It means that there's always going to be a need for a skilled labor element.
Yeah.
But... the efficiency of every project can be enhanced by that kind of technological input. And I think it's just going to go more and more and more.
Hopefully. I mean, I agree with you. It's taking a long time to trickle down, although, you see it a little bit in the suppliers. They're starting to kind of use CNC. And so, yeah, I suppose that leads me on to my next question would be off-site construction in refurbishment, especially in residential architecture. I mean, I know the conversations that we have and with our clients, and they are so sensitive to time and that the time thing always creates a problem, like we were talking about earlier. If I could say to a client, I could, once we start on site, there is the option that we retain the facade. Let's imagine it's a residential refurbishment. We retain the facade, we drop everything, and then in 3 months' time, I will be able to put three units on the back of your building and you'll be able to move in 4 months.
Yep.
Or we're looking at a traditional refurbishment with contractors on site and it will take 10 months.
If not longer. Yeah, probably.
I'm pretty sure they would go for it, but at this point in time, it's not really realistic.
I would say exactly the same. We were working with a developer during the summer to try and find, they had an airspace development opportunity.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it was for three units. And their kind of general model was less than 10 units on these kind of airspace developments. And we were doing research and trying to find suppliers within the industry that would do modular construction for them, but at this small scale.
Okay.
So three units for this scheme. We couldn't find any of an economic value that was achievable. It's got to be 20 units or more, otherwise they won't be interested. And that was across Europe.
I see.
So to the point where the developer ended up renting space themselves in a shed in, I think it was in Wales, and they were going to do it themselves.
Really?
They'd done it before, but they wanted to go back to the market and it still wasn't ready for them at this level. It's definitely taking off on a larger scale, but it's going to take its time to be economic and worthwhile for everyone.
So it was more economical for them to set up their own kind of...
Yeah, to rent space themselves and build it themselves off-site. they were wedded to the idea that this is how to do it, because they're building above existing property that were tenanted. They wanted minimal interruption or of the building, so they could build their structural frame and then just come in over the course of a month and install and then fit out these units, which we were really excited about being involved in. And then, unfortunately, wasn't able to get anywhere with that.
Right. And so was the concept that then you clad it in something on site, or was the cladding already put on?
It was partially pre-clad, and then it would be zipped up and clad over joints. And then it was just minimal fit out internally. There's a space for it in the market, and some will be happy for it. But then we've had other developers who've said, no, don't want anything to do with bathroom pods or anything like that, right, maintenance-wise, where they're retaining the asset. So there's still some scepticism.
I see.
But I think it'll be, yeah, it'll grow and grow. Yeah. It has to.
I think it has to, yeah. And then you can control waste and manage, I think, your resources better in a factory.
Yeah. Than it it's a controlled site. Environment.
Yeah, much more.
Reduced waste, everything. Time on site, wasted labour time, interruptions with neighbours and things like that. There's so many advantages to it.
And how do you deal with, I suppose you've got to transport these things, so you're limited by road.
Yeah, modular size. They weren't really concerned about access, though. It was all going to be planned, routes planned. They'll get their access done, cranes booked in, road closures. It didn't seem to phase the developer. It's just access from the market.
So if we're saying, I mean, it sounds like we're both saying, you know, we're property, our construction is ripe for some kind of disruption, but it's not happening quite yet, or maybe it's happening on the bigger schemes, mm-hmm. not on the littler, smaller schemes.
Yeah, large schemes. Yeah, large new build schemes where there's repetition, so hotels, student apartments, things like that. It's perfect for it, and it is being utilised, I believe. It's just when you're going down to a bespoke residential refurbishment scheme, or even like you say, where you can fit three units on top of each other behind a facade, it's harder to make that work.
So do you think that change, it's driven by cost ultimately? That's what will start for it to trickle down into the smaller projects. Once the cost of fabricating and delivering these things become less onerous and it starts to stack up, then more and more clients and developers will start to go for it.
I think so. If the designers continue to push and believe in it and promote it as not damaging the design side of it, it should just be, once you've got past that barrier, there's nothing to say that it can't be, well, as a finished product, the same as if it was built traditionally.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic about that because I think digital fabrication, in a way, offers the potential for customization more readily now. So
more readily than traditional?
No, not more readily. So at the moment, I think there's still that choice between you have it made on-site, kind of manually, let's call it, mm-hmm. in the traditional way, and, you know, it's very bespoke. Or if you go into a factory-controlled environment, you tend to be rolling out the same. But it feels that some of the methods of digital fabrication, you know, you don't have to retool and set everything up, and then off you go and you run 20,000 units. You can actually almost run each unit that you produce can be a different design, and you don't have to change the tooling or the setup at all.
Well, yeah, that's kind of seems like it'll be that barrier.
That's where we're going towards, yeah.
And once you've got that efficiency.
I'm optimistic that we will be able to get there because digital fabrication is lending itself more to kind of bespoke production. Okay, so then I suppose talking about the future, mm-hmm. there are rightly concerns about climate change at the moment, and I'd say construction's does not have a great track record with sustainability, although there is a lot of effort being made in that space. How do you guys promote engagement with this issue on the projects that you're working on?
Well, we try and bring it to the table as soon as, well, the earliest opportunity in terms of how are we looking at it as sustainability as a whole, for the whole scheme, from the way we design, construct, and then the building used afterwards, okay. During its life cycle. And it is getting better as an industry. But there still seems to be a case of, oh, if I have to do this, or there's a cost premium that people want to get round. So there is still some kind of pushback on it. It's got to be a mindset change because it's a responsibility of everyone in the industry to push forward with it.
And do you find that clients where they generally retain the asset or you know, they're responsible for the management of the project, are more responsive to adopting sustainable solutions. I guess they will start to see the benefits of, you know, energy efficiency, all that.
Yeah, yeah. Things like ground source heat pumps and things like that, where they're going to reduce their running costs over a reasonably short period. You see those clients realize that when you're looking at the life cycle of the whole project and the whole property, they're much more engaged. It's when you get developers who are looking just to dispose of the asset as soon as it's completed that it's not top of the agenda.
Yes, I see. But although now I think it might actually add value to the consumer, that the consumers find it, because there's so much, it's so much in the high on people's agendas, that I think the consumer is becoming more discerning and actually looking for that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's got to come from both. It's going to come from both sides. The market will respond to it and demand sustainable construction developments, and then government and legislation will push it as well. So you'll get it from both sides, and hopefully it'll push to a more greener construction industry.
Yeah. Okay, I suppose that brings me to my last question, and this is to bring out the inner designer in you. But is there a place or project or development out there that you wished you had project managed or been involved in?
It's probably going to be one of those kind of big statement projects that you can, like a landmark.
Could be a very discreet one.
No. I'd probably say the Olympic Park, one of the venues there, that would have been amazing to work on.
Oh, yeah.
I was at the Velodrome the other day, and it's still impressive, even now, 7 years on. Or maybe the Shard.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That looks like a very challenging project.
Yeah, I think it's my wife's favourite building as well. That would have been a good one to work on. But none of those scales at the moment at Regency Grove, but all in good time.
Watch the space.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, Ben, thank you very much for joining us today and joining me. And, anyone interested can find out more about Regency Grove and Ben's work on your website. And we'll put details of that in the show notes, as well as your social media platforms. But it's been great talking to you and getting an insight into the kind of challenges of delivering these projects. So I just thank you again. Thanks very much, Ben.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for listening to the Property and Architecture Podcast from De Rose Saar. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and many more, or visit our website at derosesaar.com/podcast to find all the episodes.